Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Today's reading comes from the Hebrew Scriptures. We're reading from Micah, chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Hear what the Lord says. Rise, plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Hear, you mountains, the controversy of the Lord, and you endureth foundations of the earth. For the Lord has a controversy with the people of God, and will contend with Israel. O my people, what have I done to you? And what have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what King Balak of Moab devised, what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him, and what happened from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the saving acts of the Lord. With the Lord With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before God with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? God has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
What does the Lord require
and love kindness
what
and walk
Lord
humbly with the God?
I had an abortion. Or maybe I didn't. Australian feminist Leslie Knold opened her TED Talk on abortion shame with those very words that I just said. And just like that, I wasn't there personally, she was in an enormous, like, opera hall, huge. The room got as silent as though you could hear a pin drop. Why? Because talking about abortion is not like talking about anything else. Talking about abortion means talking about sex, which means talking about birth control, which means talking about pregnancy, which means talking about abortion. So I'm really grateful to three of the physicians of our community who agreed not only to talk with me about this issue in preparation for this morning, but to go on camera for us. They're family physicians who teach medical students and resident physicians at UC Davis. I think you're going to find them helpful too. So, their names are Sarah, Kay, and Suzanne. And, let's listen, before I go any further, as they define for us some terms that we're going to be using this morning.
As somebody who provides medical care to women, a large percentage of the patients that I get to care for are women, and many of them have pregnancies. Really, abortion means the ending of a pregnancy. In the medical context, that's all that word really means. And pregnancies can end in many different ways, and we have other medical terminology that we use to get more specific about that. For example, a woman who has a miscarriage, the medical terminology or the way that we would code that medically is a spontaneous abortion. There's also an incomplete abortion or a threatened abortion. for women who've had multiple, what we would consider miscarriages. There's a term that we talk about recurrent pregnancy loss or habitual abortion, so someone who has miscarriages. All of that is in the context of someone who potentially had a planned or an intended pregnancy, but it ended, it aborted. The other way, of course, that we talk about abortion is in the context of a woman who finds herself to be pregnant and doesn't want to be, or has an undesired pregnancy, or unplanned pregnancy, and the ways in which pregnancy is electively terminated. It can be induced, it can be medically terminated, it can be surgically terminated, and there's all sorts of other specific words that get at how those procedures might be done or what medicines might be used to end a pregnancy in that context.
We use the word abortion for all of those things. We use it for miscarriage, and we also use it for elective pregnancy termination as well as medically indicated pregnancy termination. So the word abortion is actually kind of the encompassing word that we use. And so for miscarriage in medicine, we call it a spontaneous abortion. And when we talk about an elective abortion, we are talking about a pregnancy termination that is being induced that someone decides electively to have. And then we also talk about medically indicated abortions, or therapeutic abortions, we also call them, which we mean to indicate that someone has some reason that pregnancy is not safe for them or is not advised for them.
It starts with how well you know the patient or not, and then taking cues. And I think most of us start with very broad terms. So when we're taking a history, how many pregnancies have you had? How many babies have you delivered? And then saying how many babies, you know, how many abortions have you had? And when you put abortions out there, then the patient just uses the terms that they're comfortable with. They'll say, I've had 3 miscarriages, or I had a miscarriage and 2 terminations. So you try to leave it broad and then let the patient themselves choose the words that are important to them.
So I'm going to choose my words and give you my history. Take a breath. I had one abortion from an unplanned pregnancy when I was 16 years old. I had 5 unwanted, unplanned miscarriages from planned pregnancies. Does that make sense? I am one of those women that you heard Sarah describe, and it's a terrible phrase. I'm a habitual aborter. That's what they call it. I had 2 live births, and I attended the birth of my 3rd child, whose birth mother is named Jenny. And we're eternally grateful to our birth mom, Jenny, for loving Isaac and for her decision to complete her pregnancy so that Sophia and Harrison could have a little brother to love forever. In this room, by my count, which is limited, I know, there are 10 persons who are part of adoptive families. I just wanted to say that out loud. I'm proud to be part of that group. My intention this morning is to do my best to speak about abortion in a Christian manner and in an honest manner. I believe that the church community should not acquiesce to the binary positions of pro-life and pro-choice that are out there. Rather, we should or shall try to gather around the call of our faith, which is to seek justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with our God. And we try to do this as we practice our faith with a focus on communal responsibility rather than individual rights. Within the social principles, there's a statement on abortion But we also have all these other statements that reference the surrounding issues, which I'm not going to read all those, but I just really want to make sure you all know that they exist. We have statements in the social principles on ministry to those who have experienced an abortion, on adoption, on population control, on the right to health care, on the rights of women, on the rights of men, on human sexuality, and within our book of resolutions, there are additional statements on responsible parenthood, healing of post-abortion stress, support for the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, and as a side, I just want to say the United Methodist Church was a founding member of that group in 1973. Last week, January 22nd, marked the 41st anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision known as Roe versus Wade that guaranteed, in case you don't know what that means, it guaranteed women the legal right to have a safe abortion. These 41 years in between have not been easy, and the ruling by no means ended any kind of fight on this issue. And as a woman of the Christian faith and as a United Methodist pastor, I want to share that I've had the opportunity and the privilege of being a pastoral presence for women and families considering or those women who have already had an abortion. It may or may not surprise you, I don't really know, that the majority of those kinds of conversations have been with persons outside of our tradition. They've been referrals to me from other pastors who can't talk about this, or people who are in other settings where people won't talk to them about this. They're from communities where shame and fear and oppression of women is much, much stronger than many of us, I think, feel in this room. That's not to say, though, that we are immune. And in part, the reason Matt and I are speaking about many of these topics, as he said, is so that we might continue to grow in our own ability to watch over each other in love during really difficult times in our lives. The Supreme Court decision protects the rights of women to a safe and legal abortion, but we need so much more than that. Kay, who you saw last in that video, Kay received, and she's not here this morning, she's away with her daughter on a trip, but Kay received her medical training in the South. The South is of our country. It's not a place where abortion was supported. And it was a place that it was often where physicians would refuse, even though it was legal, refuse to discuss it with women. Kay also spent time in a military hospital as she was being trained, which was another place in which many physicians would not give counsel to women. There were a very few physicians who would speak openly to a pregnant patient. So I want us to listen to this brief video. Listen to Kay describe what it was actually like for her to provide something that is safe and legal and sometimes necessary for a pregnant woman. Let's listen.
We understand people not believing in it, not wanting to talk about it, but you have an obligation to care for the patient and to get them to someone who then is comfortable with it. And so it was kind of, at the one place they decided they would make a list of those of us who felt comfortable talking to patients. We didn't have the services in Greenville, but they wanted to make a list, and it felt like, it just felt really strange. So as I was telling Linda, it was like, I was very comfortable in the room with individual patients, but you couldn't really talk about it in any kind of setting. And you couldn't even talk, be like, well, Matt, why won't you talk about it? Because you were assumed to be the person in the wrong and everyone else was in the right, which is why you were on the list, you know, and the military the same way.
We need support and care and love. We don't need lists. We need the ability to share with our patients and our families and our employers what it is we're facing without being shamed and without being stigmatized. We need safe places, safe exam rooms, safe physician offices, safe churches, safe kitchen tables to discuss our feelings simply about being pregnant. And then to discuss our options without pressure or fear of judgment. We need our legal rights, but we need more than that. We also need communities that are rooted in grace in which we learn to watch over one another in love, not just when life is easy, but when it gets messy. The church ought to be on the forefront of creating this kind of community. And it's our hope that here at the table, we are going to create, or we have created, or we're in the process of creating such a place. I think all of you mostly know this. But knowing it, and living it, this is our hearts, are really often very different things. Because we come up against ourselves. And when we say we hold the Christian value of community, it often leads people to think that it's just a matter of simply gathering like-minded and acting folks together under the same roof or under the same banner, right? And we can get behind that, and it feels kind of radical even sometimes. But Christian community also brings with it the responsibility of caring for our neighbors. And this is hard stuff because choice doesn't really enter into that place. Jesus doesn't say, you got a choice here whether to love your neighbor or not. That's not what he says. Jesus says, love your neighbor. See, choice is not often thought of really as a biblical value. The reason that becomes problematic for persons who call themselves Christian is that the whole debate regarding abortion has centered around that word, choice. So I want to step away from that word this morning and really just take it off the table. We're going to look at some different words. Abortion, justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly. What does Scripture tell us about those words? So, the word abortion does not appear in Scripture, although there are two references in the Hebrew Scripture that come close, and I'm not referring to those two often quoted ones from Psalm 139, 13, knit me together in my mother's womb, and Jeremiah 1:5, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And then some preacher or some person quotes that to you, and they say, oh, well, but that's not really about abortion. And you go, what? And why did you quote it? I'm talking about that well-known passage, Exodus 21. 22 to 25, which describes a situation in which a pregnant woman who intervenes in a fight between two men is injured and she suffers a miscarriage. That's one. And I'm talking about Numbers 5, 11 to 31, which describes a husband who suspects his wife has committed adultery as being free to take her, because she's been accused, before the priests. And so she has to appear before the priest, and they're going to make her take a potion if she's guilty, a potion. And that potion is going to cause her, and I'm quoting, womb to discharge and her uterus to drop. We know what that means. If she takes it and she hasn't committed adultery, supposedly that won't happen, and she's good to go. See, this in part is why many of us take issue with the very first part of the social principle statement, which says, while individuals have always had some degree of control over when they would die, they now have the awesome power to determine when and even whether new individuals will be born. This is actually an ancient power practiced by women and men. So let's listen to Suzanne as she helps us understand this a little bit more fully, and she calls to our attention the important distinction of the word safety.
We do have that power over whether new individuals will be born, but we've kind of always had that power. I mean, women have always known of different herbs and things that are abortifacients that would induce abortion, or know of ways to cause pregnancies to end, or even to prevent pregnancy when they didn't want to be pregnant. And so while now we can really do it to a precise degree, I think throughout history people have always had some of that ability. And in fact, even Hippocrates in the Hippocratic Oath addresses it, which I think gives evidence that people were doing it back then and thinking about it back then. I think what's different now is that we have a good ability to do it in a very safe way for the woman. And I think before, it wasn't always certain and it wasn't always safe. And particularly even now in countries where abortion is illegal, a huge part of the maternal mortality in those countries is related to unsafe attempts at abortion by these old methods that people have always known about.
As I said earlier, choice is really not a biblical value, but chesed is. The words justice and loving kindness and walking humbly with God are translated from the Hebrew word chesed. This word is found 245 times in the Hebrew scriptures, and it's many times in the New Testament. And I just want to give you a little more information about this word that we've been singing and opening our whole series with. Loving kindness, or chesed, is the idea of faithful love in action, and often in the Old Testament, it refers to God's loving kindness expressed in God's covenant relationship with the people we call Israel. It's God's loyalty to covenant, God's chesed, God's persistent and unconditional tenderness, kindness, and mercy. A relationship in which God seeks after humanity with love. Chesed expresses both God's loyalty to God's covenant and God's love for God's people, along with a faithfulness on our part. We do our part to keep God's promises that we make with God. In Godly Play, we say it's a time when God comes close to us and we come close to God. It's a just way of living. In the New Testament, chesed is translated with a variety of words, including kindness, love, steadfast love, and mercy, among many others. So, chesed, or God's persistent, unconditional tenderness, kindness, and mercy, is what you heard in that scripture that Sarah read for us. And it comes out of the Old Testament book of Micah, the prophet Micah, and he is speaking in a context with no shortage of religious people. In fact, he's described widespread religiosity, where the people, especially the priests, the leaders of the day, are making, in a proud fashion, a public show of just how religious they are, with a loud lip service, maybe, to God. And it appears that business as usual religion, which is what Micah is observing, has kept the religious leaders self-satisfied and powerful. They keep their office, but the people are suffering. And so a messenger of God, that's what it takes to enter the scene and proclaim judgment with this story. against those leaders. And I think it probably was quite a shock. It would be like someone coming in here and looking at Matt and I and saying, you guys suck at this church thing. Seriously. But enter and judge Micah does. And it is in part what got me thinking about the abortion debate, where people argue and ridicule and accuse and objectify their enemy, priests and religious people, instead of loving them. And where religious people showed their worst judgment, their worst, and they heap it upon the very ones who need their tenderness. Or where they're showing their naivete too. Because that's what we do. We show our naivete by going along with certain ways of thinking. And the church, when we do this, we utterly fail to understand what we are asking for. When we, for example, just as one example, support parental notification. Let's listen to how Kay helps us with this.
Well, I believe the church is coming from a really good place, but from a very naive place, in that there are girls out there who maybe they're pregnant because of their father or their mother's boyfriend, and you're going to inform the mom that she's pregnant, and now you are putting that young woman in a place of danger. I think it would be wonderful if every teenager had a loving parent, but that is not a reality in the world that we live in, and therefore parental notification can be actually a dangerous concept.
Understanding what women need when they are pregnant is a nuanced and complicated task. As Kay said, the church is usually coming or trying to come from a really good place, but we're naive to think that there is a way in which parental notification would be safe or advised across the board. Every situation is as unique as the woman who presents. We need to be sensitive in listening to the story of the woman that is right in front of us, and listen to the way a woman frames for her very self what is happening with her. Let's listen to Sarah help us some more in understanding this.
I think in the context of the work that I do and the training that I've had and really what I teach to our medical students and residents is that part of caring for people, for women, is to help them feel comfortable and use the terms that they use, or to understand things from someone else's framework. And so in the context of taking care of a woman who, for example, is having what we would call a miscarriage, if she refers to it as a miscarriage, that's generally the terminology that I will use, and I have a sense of what that is. But if someone comes in and wants to talk about how can she get an abortion, absolutely, then that's the term that I would use with the patient and have a conversation from there.
Okay. You see, abortion is just one of the many options that are available to pregnant women. Why is it that women have abortions? I think there are two basic reasons. One is the fear that they cannot handle the financial and physical demands of the child. And the fear, the other, is that having the child will in some way destroy relationships that are important to them. So let me be a little bit more specific. An example of the first fear, the inability to handle the child financially or physically, is something like this. A single mother of two children, the younger of whom has Down syndrome, she's already living with that. This woman recently discovers that she's pregnant. She believes abortion is wrong for her. However, the father of the child will not commit himself to helping her raise the child, and she's afraid that she cannot handle raising a third child. on her own. That's one example. An example of the second fear, the fear of destroying relationships, is the woman who becomes pregnant and was told by her husband that he would leave her if she did not have an abortion. She didn't want to lose her husband, so she had the abortion. Later, he left her anyway. And I would go so far as to venture to say most teenage pregnancies, many of them, fall into this category: fear of destroying relationships. In both examples, and I know there are many others, a woman has an abortion not because she's really exercising her freedom of choice, although we talk about it that way, but really, she feels like she has no choice. See? In each case, the responsibility for caring for the child, had she had the child, would have rested squarely and solely on her. You see the difference? According to what we say as United Methodist Christian people, comes out of our book of worship, when a person gets baptized, the congregation is asked a question. Matt and I ask it in this room, and here's the question. Will you nurture one another in the Christian faith and life and include these persons, whoever's up here about to be baptized, now before you in your care? That's what we ask. And here's what we respond. With God's help, we will proclaim the good news and live according to the example of Christ. We'll surround these persons with a community of love and forgiveness that they may grow in their trust of God and be found faithful in their service to others. We will pray for them that they may be true disciples who walk in the way that leads to life. We make this promise because we know that no adult only belongs to himself or herself. And no child belongs only to his or her parents. It's very hard for American people to hear and understand that. Because of that, every young one is our child, the church's child to care for. Every adult is our brother or sister, the church's neighbor to care for. It's not a choice. It's a responsibility. So when you hear us talk about growing our church, a lot of people think all we're talking about is numbers. But a huge portion of growing a church means we want to meet people's real needs. And this kind of growth comes from intimacy, one with another. It comes from the messy stories that we share with each other. Growth comes from loving each other into our lives and out the other side. It rises out of God's beautiful and loving chesed. But it's not always like this. And we're going to have communion, and you may have heard this a million times, or maybe you've never heard it before, but listen up. Because this is what we say in that communion liturgy. God says, you and everything you see around you is my beloved creation. All of it is good. And then right after that we say, but it wasn't good for long. See, there's the mess. Because God's people could not be faithful despite God's generosity and goodness. Walking humbly with God carries with it the demand that we live in right relationship with God and with our community, all of God's family. When we restrict a person's access to finding the services that they need and the ability of physicians to offer needed and legal health services, we're denying God's generosity and goodness. When a person who longs to become a parent cannot get jobs, can't get employment, or can't even get access to health care, or all of the other things that make parenting possible, it's so expensive, we're denying God's generosity and goodness. When a woman knows that giving her child to an adoptive forever family is what is best for her, yet we question and shame her and we say, oh, I could never do that. It's such a great gift you're giving. Yeah, it is. But there's shame when we say that to a woman. Instead of helping her find a willing placement, Isaac came to us because somebody in my church knew what Mark and I were seeking. She knew. She's the one who made the connection. When we deny that, we deny God's generosity and goodness. When a person is willing to adopt, but they are required to spend tremendous amounts of money or to wade through endless red tape to find their forever child, all the while millions of children are sitting, waiting for their forever families. We are denying God's generosity and goodness. And when we don't trust women to let our hearts and theirs be woven together in love, to enter into sometimes one of the hardest decisions, we deny God's generosity and goodness. So the pro-life and the pro-choice categories present for us a binary argument, and I think we can turn it in its head, you know, turn it upside down. Pro-life, turn it over. Christians are called to die. Don't pretend otherwise. We're supposed to die to sin. We're supposed to die in martyrdom. It's happened throughout history. We die on the cross. Another tenet of pro-life argument is that children are the hope of the future. No. No. We find hope in God and in God's reign on earth, which is made known through the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Children are beautiful, but don't put that on them. Pro-choice, turn that on its head. Choice equals individual comes first, no matter what. It doesn't equal love your neighbor, which is what we're called to do. It's uncomfortable to say that. I know it. We can turn the argument upside down in other ways as well. As I said, we can refuse to shame those considering abortion or to give over to the shame you hold yourself if, like me, you had an unwanted pregnancy and you chose abortion when you were 16 years old. We can speak openly and with love for the child that has been given to us for adoption. Or we can, even riskier, come out and speak openly and with love for the child that we have given away for adoption. In so doing, what happens is we empower a Christian response which centers on the responsibility of the whole Christian community to seek justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. You see, when you follow Jesus, biology isn't what makes you a parent. Water and the Spirit do through baptism. Baptism makes all adults Christian parents of every child in our midst. But what would that mean? First and foremost, it means we would have to talk about these things. See? And talking about abortion means talking about sex, which means talking about birth, and birth control, which means talking about pregnancy, which means talking about birth, which means talking about parenting and families and loving each other, and it's so messy. Where will it all lead, right? Where will it all lead? It leads to following Jesus. So I just want to close with a few statistics which might be helpful to some of us. Statistically, we know that there are about 20 elective abortions per 1,000 women of childbearing age, and they say that that's us between 15 and 44. This means that in this room, over the next 5 years, there are probably between 5 and 7 children that could be born, that may or may not be born. Would we be able to live into our baptismal covenant and say, yes, I will join you in making that decision and parenting that child no matter what the outcome? Statistically, we know that right now in the U.S., there are over 400,000 children in our foster care system. And that out of those, over 61,000 have had both their parents' parental rights terminated. That means 61,000 children are ready to find forever families. And because we already have within this room parents, adoptive parents, foster parents, we know that we can grow this way. We already know that. We're good at it. We can't simply throw the issue of abortion in the faces of women and say it's all about choice. You have it. You just go make one. We cannot simply throw the issue of abortion in the faces of women and say, you decide, you pay, you bear the consequences all by yourself of your decision. As the church, which is rooted in grace and committed to growing in faith, our response to the abortion issue must be to shoulder the responsibility to care for everyone, all women and children and men. And we try to do this with chesed, by seeking justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly. And we cannot do otherwise and still call ourselves a church. All means all. If we close down the conversation in the face of our own limitations and fears, we close our doors in the faces of men, women, and children. And when we close our doors to them, we're closing our doors in the face of Christ. So what do we want to be responsible for?
Jesus called us to live into that question around a table, to gather together for a simple and sacred meal, to hold the mess of life, to hold that in God's chesed, in God's loving justice. And so we gather around that story, around that truth, and around that hope as we come to this table in this moment.
Peace in our families, peace.